everyone. Welcome to another episode of Defense Deconstructed on the Canadian Global Affairs Institute's podcast network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Dave Perry. On today's show, which we're recording October 11th, 2019, we're going to be discussing recent developments in Syria, including the U.S. administration's declaration that ISIS has been defeated, their withdrawal of troops from Syria, Turkey then invading northern Syria and clashing with Kurdish forces. And we're having this discussion today with Lieutenant General retired Mike Day, a fellow at the Canadian Global Affairs Institute. Mike, welcome to Defense Deconstructed.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Glad to be here.
Mike, you've been fairly active on Twitter talking about this situation. Start us off by giving us your sense of what's happened and hit the highlights about what some of the consequential impacts of what we've seen the last few days are, both for the region and beyond.
Right. Thanks, Dave. If we start, obviously, with the, and I think it's an understatement to say, somewhat surprising declaration by the President of the United States, I think that the immediate large-term consequence has been well covered in that he essentially, and in a very explicit fashion, authorized Erdogan and Turkey to essentially invade Syria and conduct operations against the Kurds. A couple of things to note at that front end. First of all, these operations, they're not created overnight. This was not put in play as of the president's tweet. These operations are complex issues. They require staging of forces, et cetera. So this clearly has been in the works for weeks, if not months, more likely months, quite frankly, given the size of the forces that we think are being used, given the intensity of the force. And so all Turkey was waiting for in a military sense really was the green light, right? The analog I use is like Eisenhower on D-Day. He was just waiting for the weather to calm. Right. All they were waiting for was the green light. And then the fact that they were able to launch immediately is something. I think the second contextual comment I would make is we are getting imperfect, incomplete information. And those are two different things. The information we're getting is not necessarily going to be accurate. And we're absolutely not getting the complete piece. It is reasonable, however, based on what we're seeing and based on, I think, what many of us experienced in a variety of theaters around the world, is to assume that based on what we are seeing, the scope of activities is likely significantly greater than is being reported. And the reporting will catch up. That's not an indictment of the reporting. That's just the reality that the type of assets to report effectively on these things aren't in place. So with those things in context, maybe I could spend a moment or two just talking really about, you know, the two axes of impact, if I can. The first is we need to think about the impact happening in an immediate sense, in a midterm sense, in a longer term sense. And then we need to draw another line down our graph. And it really looks at the tactical consequences, the operational consequences to the operational plan that's being used, the strategy for the region, and then the geostrategic implications. And we tend to get caught up in a life of that dynamic, when in actual fact, those impacts are being felt just across the whole domain. So yeah, that's how I would start to describe the situation and how I think we should best evaluate what the consequence is.
So to stick with the tactical, the operational aspects in the region, so northern Syria was one part of a wider set of operations against ISIS, of which Canada was a contributor and which many other members of NATO, including Turkey, had an involvement in. And that structure stretched across the region. So certainly for Canada, I think it was three or four different countries where Canada had forces that were contributing to the overall mission in the Middle East. Just start us off by talking about the impact about this specific activity in Syria with what the Turkish forces are doing. What would be the impact on that for the other forces in the area? Because in coalition operations, all these things have to be deconflicted. You don't want to have forces firing accidentally on coalition forces. So what would the practical impact of the Turkish operation be on the other activity in the area, the coordination at headquarters, those types of aspects?
Right. And this is great because my sense is a lot of this is actually being missed. And for some larger geostrategic issues, and I don't mean to diminish any of those, but actually the potential for real real consequence is extremely high at the tactical end. And let me explain that. And recognizing that I think that the Canadian government has been quite clear about where the scope of, geographically, the scope of their activities are, which I think remains on the Iraq side, vice the Syria side. But the application is, quite frankly, exactly the same. And the first thing is, tactically, the allied forces, coalition-led, American-led, have been working literally hand in glove, side by side, with their Kurdish compatriots. In order to do so, there is a set of rules that are set up, and we follow those rules. This is an experience-based, lessons learned, best practices. We, the Western world, certainly the Five Eyes community, have been doing this now for decades, going back to Afghanistan and prior to that. And so we understand that when we have deployed forces on the ground, you have to have a rule set in place. And one of those critical rules is actually about force protection of your own forces. And the second is about the rules of engagement, the levels of force that are authorized based on the discretionary decisions of the commanders and the individuals on the ground, right? And what is essential to that piece is, because there is a co-location and because you're working hand in glove, you have something called designated friendly forces. And you're authorized to act on their behalf in self-defense because they're part of your team. So the very first thing that would have had to have happened, and what's clear, by the way, there was no consultation pre-warning, as you said in your preamble, so none of this was gamed out. But almost overnight, and probably to a minute, the coalition forces in that region had to effectively change their rules of engagement so that they could not provide force protection to the allied force with whom they've been working, the Kurds, that is, with whom they have been working for weeks, months, in some cases, years. So imagine the tactical impact of co-location. If those rules of engagement hadn't changed, if the authorities hadn't changed, and the Kurds had been engaged by the Turks, and the coalition forces responded to provide what, quite frankly, would be reasonable, measured, proportional a response, what would happen if a NATO ally had fired on a NATO ally? So it's that sort of tactical consequence that people aren't really thinking about. Now, I know we've heard that the Americans are retiring from the battlefield, etc. So there's a second consequence there, right? Battlefield intelligence, certainly at the beginning of a campaign, and certainly at the beginning of an aerial campaign, whether deliberately or not, is not always going to target purely military targets. I think we've seen some, whether it's deliberate, incidental collateral damage, we've seen a number of events. And so if we accept that there's going to be a physical dislocation between the coalition forces on the ground and their Kurd partners, that by themselves doesn't make them safe, because they could be subject to just being in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong bomb falling, et cetera. And so you don't have to game those situations out for very long before you realize that all you need is, one American soldier killed by one Turkish bomb, or maybe a Russian-backed allied force bomb, or maybe an Iranian-backed allied force bomb. And all of a sudden, we have a real geostrategic issue on our hands. And so the tactical consequences of not thinking this through, not having a plan in place to disengage, to separate, to create no fire lines, all these things, that's all being jury-rigged. And when you jury-rig things of this nature, there are going to be fragilities, vulnerabilities, and gaps.
So to keep that line of thought going with the air picture, so you have a situation where across multiple different countries, you have coalition basically divvying up control over the airspace, trying to deconflict and coordinate where various allied aircraft are flying and when. This is now done a quite significant rejigging of that, I would think. So you're trying to keep what the Turks are doing, because they are conducting airstrikes in support of their operation in part of the region where the allies had been flying before. And further complicating this is that I think at least at one point, it wasn't just Turkish aircraft flying out of Turkey in support of allied operations, because Turkey's got a number of fairly important airfields that other NATO forces in the past have used. So can you speak a little bit about that aspect of this? How does the air picture work, in noting that there have been there've been incidents where aircraft were shot down apparently inadvertently in the past couple of years in the region?
Absolutely. So essentially, the air battle is run through something called CAOCA, a Coalition Air Operations Center. And you've described it very well. There is not just a deconfliction of use of the airspace, but there's actually a very ordered method, method-focused use of the airspace. And so, again, contingency plans are often in place for most likely events. What happens if we lose a coalition partner? It's inconceivable to me that somebody in the CAOC would have anticipated, or anyone in the coalition chain of command would have anticipated this decision, right? Like, just because it's now clear, because we've been told by American leadership that there was no consultation on this with allies, etc. So what you've got all of a sudden is a coherent, comprehensive air picture that deconflicted and addressed some of the problems, as you said, with some planes being shot down over the years accidentally. All of a sudden, facing a really difficult decision. So it's either being deconflicted actively by the chaos or it's not. Both of those are actually tremendously problematic. The second, I don't think we need to expand on. If it's not being deconflicted, oh my Lord, it is literally chaos out there. But if it is being deconflicted and the chaos is tracking and working with the Turks to make sure that there is no, I don't want to say friendly fire incidents, but there are no non-deliberate type incidents, then it begs the question, are they sharing intelligence? Are they sharing target packages? If they're not, what happens when the Coalition Air Center becomes aware that an airstrike is going to take place on something that, by the law of armed conflict, clearly is not a military target? What are our responsibilities there as a coalition? So, again, with forethought and planning, you can't mitigate all of this, but you can mitigate a tremendous amount of this by providing advice of, sort of what the agreed to boundaries will be, right? You can create some no-fly zones. You can create some safe havens. Like, they're not perfect, but at least they help mitigate that. At the moment, it's not clear what role the Coalition Air Operations Center is playing. Is it completely blind? Is it merely reactive? Is it deconflicting? Which, by the way, is an implicit acknowledgement that it is allowing the Turks to bomb targets in Syria. So this is tremendously problematic. And you have to question, what position that puts the command team in terms of their responsibility.
To keep going on that a little bit further, so the relationship between all of that activity and the NATO command structure, what would be the interrelationship there? So again, Turkey is, although increasingly a difficult, I guess, ally within the North Atlantic Alliance. What's the relationship between the structure with NATO and the operation activity, the coalition activity that's been happening with varying levels of involvement, depending on what part of the mission you're talking about? But how would that interface with the wider alliance set of structures? What would that mean? Example, as I touched on earlier, Turkey in that part of the region is the outer limit of the alliance with some important airfields. What would potentially be changing with that type of dynamic?
Well, I mean, NATO is a remarkable beast. And I would just preface all my comments to say any and every effort to keep NATO together and whole, I try and including, by the way, Turkey's membership is worth, just tremendous effort and some compromise and sacrifice. And that sounds like we're going to condone things, et cetera. It doesn't. But you have to, again, look at it from the larger picture. And that obviously complicates the issue. Within the NATO structure, there are a variety of agreements, standing agreements of how NATO forces support each other, how NATO countries support each other. And you've mentioned the use of Turkish airfields, et cetera. There will be agreements about refueling. There will be agreements about storage of ammunition. There will be agreements of, use of sovereign airspace in Turkey, et cetera. Erdogan's already come out quite publicly and said, quite shockingly, weaponizing, I think, was, J.M. Davis's comments, and she was right on when she said, look, this is weaponizing refugees. If he's willing to do that sort of thing, you really have to question, what is he willing to do that would impact on NATO's status and use in Turkey. And by the way, it's not just airfields. The United States has a very significant naval presence there. NATO has the Land Forces Component Command in Turkey. So, we're focused on the air piece just as an illustrative example, as opposed to, capturing the whole situation. There are massive consequences to this and how it will be handled. So there's an immediate tactical piece in terms of how does that inhibit the provision of support from Turkey. We've already talked about the deconfliction of the airspace, but what does this mean to the long-term status of NATO forces in Turkey, etc.?
You're listening to an episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. These engaging conversations from the front lines of policy and politics are brought to you by the Canadian Association of Defense and Security Industries. Switching gears a little bit to talk about the potential impacts of this for similar operations like the ones of which are just which in the process of being discontinued. So the United States in particular has led a Special Operations Forces mission where it's worked with Syrian groups, Syrian Kurds on the ground, training them, advising them, assisting them. And I think by most of the accounts that you can read that this has been viewed as a particularly successful example of that type of an operation. Walk through some of the, what you see as the potential impacts to me, because to me, it would, if you want to be cynical, you could say this isn't the first time that Kurds have been abandoned by the West. But I think that this is, I would think that if I were some future local force looking at working with Western governments or American forces on the ground, this might make you rethink the level of commitment you could expect going forward.
Yeah, so I think it's super important to recognize, back to my two-dimensional graph, the consequences are not just on the ground, and I'll talk about those in terms of those teams, but longer term, et cetera, notwithstanding the historic precedent that you've rightfully identified. First and foremost, I've never served in Syria, et cetera, but you know, I have a career involved in our special forces community, and I have lots of friends around the world who have been involved in Syria, et cetera. And anecdotally, I would say to you, their comments would be, out of all the missions we've run around the world and all the various theaters we've deployed to, they would cite the Kurds, if not the most reliable, effective partner force they have worked with. Certainly, they would have to be in sort of the top one or two, et cetera. They, you know, the comments of my erstwhile compatriots who have served, were serving there up to a couple of days ago, would tell you know, they are ferociously devoted. They have become an increasingly disciplined, effective force, and they are reliable partners. You know, meaning when, you know, it comes a time for hard people to do tough and hard things, they're always there. And so that's not always the case around the world. So we need to understand that's the start point. And then overnight, after building this critical relationship, overnight, collectively, the Western world has abandoned them. And so here are the immediate consequences. The tactical plans, you know, the day-to-day engagements are all predicated on the level of support that the coalition has provided. The defensive plan, sort of contingency plans, is based on a size of force and a support of, you know, air assets, et cetera, that are no longer available to the Kurds. So all of a sudden, every tactical plan they have has disappeared. There's that. Second, there is the trust morale issue. Up till now, you know, I think the technical term is batshit crazy. I, you know, that's what's coming out of the White House. Up till now, there is a tremendous amount of mitigation that on the ground operators and commanders can affect to truly keep that operation up and rolling and going and everything else. But you can only do so much. And it's reached that point where they can't mitigate it. You know, that trust is now broken. And no matter how much there may be personal affection, admiration, and support at the individual tactical level, it's very clear that that isn't sufficient to keep the game going and what have you. So that's what you have. And the consequence is not just to the Kurds tactically, as they're described, not just to that relationship. The Americans have lost the singularly most valuable tool they had in theater to fight ISIS. You know, and I've said about this publicly, what we're going to see is we're going to see a string of sequential activities. We're going to see some atrocities. I think we're starting to see those. We're going to see some escape and leakage of ISIS captives. I think we're beginning to see some things happen in the prisons. We're going to see a reignition of some of those conflicts in that region because they'll be able to seize that moment and rebuild. They're revitalized, etc. Those are all the consequences to, you know, the men and women on the ground. So we have the impact of the individual on the ground, and we can return actually to the morale factor, the ethical factor, the position that puts those operators in. But the consequential issue is And let's just use the Americans as an illustrative example, because, of course, this abandonment has been led by the Americans. Just count up around the world how many places the American Special Forces are engaged at the moment in some kind of partnership, training partnership, activity partnership, etc. So, you know, if I went to a map, you know, on a non-classified map of things that the Americans declare they're doing, I could come up with about 16 places in the first minute. Imagine what every single one of those partner nations' indigenous forces are thinking and what they're now preparing for as a consequence in terms of sharing intelligence, in terms of putting themselves at risk to support, by the way, not their objectives, but American foreign policy objectives. And so the consequences of this on the ground are not just felt immediately by those tremendously unfortunate operators who have essentially are betraying their partners, but it's being felt on the ground tactically. I promise you, by every special forces operator, American special forces operator around the world, because I guarantee you, they're all being asked, are we next? Right? Is this what we can expect from you? Oh, by the way, we're giving you insights to what's happening in our country. We're putting ourselves in harm's way. You know, let's remember the thousands of Kurds that have, yes, they've been fighting for their own land and everything else, but they have been essentially fighting the American battle. There's direct consequences tactically around the world today.
Beyond the tactical, it would strike me there'd be two wider strategic impacts on the United States' relationship with its allies, both indigenous forces and traditional allies like Canada. One would be that the decision-making that the president's displayed in the last week has shown that he is actually willing to, apparently against advice or even just not seeking out or soliciting advice, on his own make snap decisions with the very significant ramifications that you have walked through. But it's also showing that there's also a willingness to reverse some of these implications, even if you kind of did it in the right way, where you would walk forward and have a coordinated response, so you're not, as you're describing, giving people hours to respond to local situations, but that there's a demonstration that of the other manifestations of Trump's relationship with allies, you know, being far more aggressive in public about contributions and burden sharing in NATO, calling out allies in the Pacific about, you know, stepping things up. There's been a number of things that he's done that are I think seriously calling into question how the United States views its allied relationships, kind of on top of the snap decision making. What do you see coming from that if you were a Canadian thinking about how we're going to work with, or if we're going to work with, the United States in various places around the world?
You know, one of the lessons I certainly absorbed from my time running the International Security Policy Branch for National Defense was, apropos given the conversation down in the States, the quid pro quo of building coalitions is all about, I will do this for you if you do this for me, etc. And that's based on reasonable faith and trust, you know, that certain things that are promised will remain constant. And the capriciousness, and that's really all we're talking about, the capriciousness of the current administration makes those conversations just tremendously difficult. And so countries, whether it be Canada, whether it be Great Britain, to be honest, it really doesn't matter, but there's a standard cohort that recognize that up till maybe the last 2.5 years, association with the Americans, the benefits were greater than the costs in a macro sense, not in a military sense, but in a macro sense. But all of a sudden, if you try to think ahead and there was a serious, larger scale regional conflict, you know, a desert storm kind of thing, where America had to lead the building of the leading of a significant coalition force, that's predicated on the Americans being trustworthy enough to provide certain things. Now, that trust is gone, you know, and so that makes the decision
that completely
cycle
that fast.
Oh, yeah, done. Now, can they rebuild it? Absolutely. And even if he goes back on his word, you know, that damage is done. You know, and that's not to say that countries will not contribute to future coalitions, etc., but the dynamic has fundamentally changed, because it will no longer be predicated on we can trust them to do certain things. And no matter what the bureaucrat says, I haven't been one, or the senior military commander says, we know, excuse the pun, that they can be trumped by a tweet.
Right.
And everything that was agreed to essentially can be dismissed with a wave of the hand. That's a remarkable change in terms of how states have worked And certainly since the end of the Cold War, where we've had this increased anarchy of states, its coalitions of the willing, etc., that's a remarkable change. And I don't think people give that enough credence. And certainly if you're uneducated, I don't mean dumb, but you're uneducated and you're not intellectually curious, and that appears to characterize the current president, none of those consequences matter to you because you don't bother even looking at those consequences. So what does that mean to countries like Canada, et cetera? We always should ask ourselves, Mali's a good example, why are we committing men and women in harm's way? What is the Canadian objective that is being met? How do we measure that objective against the cost to the blood and the coin of the realm? Meaning, how much is going to cost taxpayers, and are we really jeopardizing the lives and the safety of our men and women in uniform? Like, that's their job. I'm not saying that they should have zero risk, right? Risk it, you sign up to that. But a government should be able to explain that. How does a future Prime Minister of Canada next year say, I'm sending a battle group, two ships, a six-pack of planes, Special Operations Task Force to support the Americans in the following theater, no matter where it is, et cetera. But there's significant risk. There's significant tactical risk, first protection risk, et cetera. We have come to an agreement that for example, the complete med evacuation chain will be provided by the Americans. And we're doing it because of the following reasons. I don't know how you can defend that publicly today if you're a Canadian political leader.
Right.
The dynamic is...
This is, I guess, for you, it's introduced enough questions in your minds about whether or not with a tweet or two, that commitment could be walked back.
Right. So up till now, look, he's fiddled around the edges, Trump. He's fiddled around the edges. He's been tremendously damaging. I've described him as, I think he is the greatest single threat to global security and stability that there is at the moment. But again, much of his musings, you know, have, I don't want to say being ignored, you know, but they haven't had an impact that could not be mitigated by subsequent layers below him. And, you know, again, not talking out of turn, I'm not putting any of my, you know, American colleagues in a difficult position, but they work unbelievably hard to mitigate the damage. You can't mitigate this kind of damage that he's invoked. And you can't, if you're a political leader of a Western world, you cannot ignore this lesson learned.
Well, Mike, thanks for coming on today and offering your thoughts on some of these more consequential impacts longer term. The last question to you, as we tape this just prior to the Thanksgiving weekend, what will you be reading these days?
I'm, as you know, because you tease me about this all the time, I'm in the middle of a multi-year effort to complete a PhD. So I'm actually, my reading is mostly following a qualitative methodology approach, you know, these days. So it's pretty singularly affected, you know, by that, unfortunately. So that's less interesting to most of the leaders, you know, that I'd like to inspire, say, hey, you've got to read this. It's great. But I will say to you, because I had breakfast with a friend yesterday morning, we exchanged reading notes. In addition to that sort of relatively dry, but quite frankly, very useful construct, I'm taking that at Nipsia, by the way, is I have found myself rereading Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, which in moments of, you know, great doubt, it just recenters. I always would say to any future aspiring leader, etc., there's a great book to just to remind yourself that you remain in control of the things you remain in control of.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for that, and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Yeah, thanks very much, Steve, and thanks for reaching out. I enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Defense Deconstructed, part of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute's podcast network. Our guest today was Mike Day. If you like the show, please remember to give us a rating on iTunes. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The podcast is brought to you by our team in Ottawa. Thanks go to our producer, Jay Rankin, and Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Dave Perry, and thanks for listening to this episode of Defense Deconstructed.